Griffin Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence with Prince, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you and our guest for the next hour this evening on January the 14th, still on the West Coast or on the East Coast, already the morning of January 15th and in the Central Time Zone as well. Oh, lots of things going on. I think I should read something that came my way via the website educate-yourself.org. It's entitled, Six U.S. Cities Possible Targets of False Flag Ops Before Obama Takes Office. And this is written by Ken Adachi from educate-yourself.org. Six U.S. Cities Possible Targets of False Flag Ops Before Obama Takes Office. And he goes on to say, it has come to my attention that there are six primary U.S. cities and four secondary cities in the United States that may be the targets of false flag terrorist attacks before Obama takes office on January 20th, 2009. This might include any sort of dramatic crisis event, like a nuclear plant going up or some sort of major catastrophe, which will naturally be blamed on Islamic fundamentalist extremists. The six primary cities are New York, Miami, Atlanta, Denver, Los Angeles, and Kansas City. The secondary target cities are Minneapolis, Detroit, Houston, and San Francisco. This information was brought to my attention by indirect paranormal means, which might include dowsing or psychic reading, or a precognition, or a dream resulting from having fallen asleep after consumption of a grande bean burrito from El Gordito's Taco Wagon, located on the corner of Alameda and Disney Way. This information is intended exclusively to alert all conspiracy theorists who think 9/11 was an inside job and that the government is under the control of subversive infiltrators, fifth columnists, and New World Order sellouts. However, this information is not intended to alarm or concern people who regularly tune in to CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, CNN, or NPR for their news and political talk shows. The purpose of staging a false flag terrorist attack is to use the event as a pretext for declaring martial law and to suspend all constitutional liberties and guarantees in order to further the goals of the New World Order to neutralize and destroy America by establishing a totalitarian police state from within. The purpose of blowing the whistle on planned false flag terrorist black ops by naming the targets in close proximity to the attack date is to stymie the Zionist-led manipulators who have already clearly demonstrated their work on 9/11, the Bali bombing, the London bombings, and the Madrid train bombing, and abort the events before they take place. To that end, we are not concerned about those who would mock, criticize, or ridicule this warning. If I didn't think the information was credible, you wouldn't be reading this notice. Our desire is to see the next 6 days pass uneventfully and to witness on January 20th the swearing-in of the first Kenyan-born national to ever become president of the United States. What an historic event that will be. Ken Adachi. So, shall we take this seriously? Well, we've been following false flag events for about 7 years now, and I can tell you, actually, it's even closer to 8 years, but let's round it off and say 7 years. And many of these cities have come up at one point or another. In fact, certain events have taken place, and always in conjunction with the release of a Bin Laden tape. Now, I'm not reading Ken Adachi. This is your host here. I can also tell you that today they released another Bin Laden tape, this an audio tape. And CNN ran a special on this Anderson Cooper show, 360, and they showed very youthful photographs of Bin Laden, which is kind of interesting because everybody in the know seems to think he died in December of 2001, yet they still bring these little snippets of news out regarding Obama or al-Zawahiri, his second in command. So if we're to take any of this seriously, now we have a Bin Laden tape to go along with this. Something is afoot. And do your own research. If you hear about anything, by all means, let us know at Evan and Footprints. You can go to my website, directlightproductions.com, send me an email, and some folks are already doing that, believe it or not. So we need to get this information out. Now, if nothing happens, then we can assume that just publicizing it may have put a damper on it. It's very difficult to tell, though, because these folks do anything, and they do it right in front of our noses. With that, I welcome back to Evident Footprints again a very esteemed guest. He is an attorney who specializes in various aspects of the law related to constitutional rights as well as antitrust law. And his expertise is in really in many areas. Those are his fortes. We're going to be talking about some of the things that are going on in the world today. We've talked about these in the past. And of course, things are still transpiring. They seem to really be just off the shelf, so to speak. And with that, I want to invite back to Evident Footprints, Mr. Carl Pearson. Carl, well, good evening.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed listening to what you were saying. I've had some experience in the 9/11 movement. I'm actually trying right now to have a petition signed in New York City, which would actually, if we got on the ballot with this initiative, would make me the New York City Attorney General and would create a commission to have an investigation of 9/11. With a subpoena power.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of interesting that 9/11 hasn't died. In fact, it's gotten a second wind, so to speak, maybe even a third or fourth wind. We've been talking about it on the show this past week. I had Dr. Kasem Khalil on the show both Monday and Tuesday, and he has written the book Wrongly Blamed, and he's revised the book and added some things. Of course, he's tracked down 11 of the 19 hijackers, and they're all alive and well, living in various parts of the Middle East, and they're appalled that their names have been used in this charade. And he and I have been sort of comparing our work and actually are working together right now. So there are new revelations regarding 9/11 coming out. You would probably want to talk to both of us, I would say.
Sounds interesting.
So I'll leave it at that for right now. But this has been a hot topic. I spent the last weekend going over the original films released by NBC Nightly News, and I found very many anomalies in that. And it raises some questions as to how someone knew to set up cameras to film these planes coming in at a level of 85 stories high. How do they accomplish that? I'm wondering from what vantage point, what building they would have been able to capture from both sides, as well as from the rear and underneath, all these different perspectives of the planes hitting those towers. Seems quite impossible to do. It would have had to have been photoshopped, is what we're saying. And we've got a lot of other evidence that points to antimatter type weapons having been used. Are you still with us, Carl?
I am, and I was thinking about the molten lava that was found that simmered for weeks in at the very bottom of Building 7, which was a strong indication that explosives were used in the building.
Yes, they did use some explosives.
Way beyond what oil could have done, so that the argument that some kind of oil went off could not have created the temperatures that were found and recorded at Columbia University.
Yes.
The heat and the seismic events.
Yes.
There's also an
audio recording of a 911 call, meaning emergency call. A young lady described the fact that there was no fire and the heat was unbearable. And that would be a phenomenon of some sort of a scalar pulse oriented or antimatter weapon. We've got some more information as to what could have caused that too, just within the last few days. So definitely, there are some things, to be brought forth.
What's the likelihood that the Obama administration will go into this?
What's the likelihood, you're asking?
Yes. Zero to 100.
Yeah, there are rumors that there's something afoot.
Really?
Yeah, to stop that, yes. And what I read just now gives all the appearance of something planned to blame on terrorists again, just to enact martial law. And that would preempt an inauguration.
Assuming we get through that and that it doesn't happen that way, what's the likelihood that Congress or the new administration would have an investigation once again of 9/11?
Oh, I doubt that there's any difference. This is just an issue of who's controlling the purse strings as far as the corruption goes.
So it's just not going to happen.
No, I wouldn't see it like that. But that's not saying that this can't be started. Okay, that this has to be handled in a way that the awareness comes to the American people, and we can't rely on the mainstream media. From day one, from what I reviewed of all the film being shot. By the way, there's an independent video shot by regular citizens. Pretty much in the proximity of the World Trade Center. And the girl happened to be filming at the time the first explosion occurred. And she refers to a bomb or an explosion. No visible plane anywhere. Very, very unique perspective. The closest film of any of the shots that we've been shown. A matter of a couple of blocks away. You can hear the fire engines on the video, which you can't on any of the mainstream media's video, other than when the buildings go down. They made sure that they let us hear all the fear that was going on. So we'll catch you up to speed on this.
So I have some plans that are quite different than 9/11. It's really a plan to try to bring wealth back to the people, where we don't have to rely or hope that the federal government is going to do anything, because the likelihood that they're going to bring back the country and do it quickly is not that good. I think we're in terrible shape. But the country itself can do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in agreement. In fact, we had a series of shows on the past week, and really, you know this from the last time you were on the show. We've been talking about individual responsibility and taking things into our own hands, sort of declaring our sovereignty and making some things happen so that people can earn a living, so they can feed their families and support themselves. Now, we've talked about your websites. How's your new site coming, by the way? Dailybsd.com?
I haven't done much with it. I have so many websites. Like, I've got 100 websites, and I just can't pay attention to them. I mean, I'm more willing to build the 100 first. than I am to go back and start working with the others. I mean, it's more like a magazine. A person that publishes a magazine really doesn't go back over the articles and change them.
Mm-hmm.
He just keeps publishing new magazines, new monthly editions. So to me, a website is like a magazine or a magazine article. And
okay, Seth, excuse me, Carl, if you can hear me. I've lost
Your
audio.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, I got it back. Okay.
Okay.
These anomalies. Okay, you were saying again, if I
that,
can have
that, that a website to me is like a magazine article, and that mm-hmm. magazines don't go back and update an article. They wouldn't do that, and I can't. I can't go back and update 100 websites every day.
Yeah.
So I'm more interested in writing new websites than writing old websites.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The one topic I'd like to discuss tonight is myclads.com. Now, I know some folks who are interested in doing this on a community level. So that's going to happen very quickly for you.
Terrific, because it'll bring income in.
Yes. What's amazing...
There's no quicker way to bring income into a town than doing something like I envision with my website, MyClads. It's got to be a sure winner for a town.
Mm-hmm. I find it quite amazing that you've calculated a town of 10,000 people could generate an additional $250 million in work that's not being performed, basically.
Yeah, that's the maximum. I estimated there were, at $30 an hour, the town of Hopeless, Indiana, has a $250 million worth of hours of their residents that are not being used, that the residents could put to use in making money. So $250 million, now you can't fill up every hour for these people. But at $30 an hour, you really don't need to fill up all the hours. If you could fill up 40% of the hours, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Because that 40% of 8 would be 3.2 times 30. We're close to $100 if you only have 40% utilization, for example, of the hours that a person has available.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see where you can bring in $100 or $200 a day per person. And for people that don't have any money, who are losing their homes and don't know what to do and are waiting for jobs to open up, jobs are not going to be opening up. I mean, we're going to have some token programs of hiring a few people or paying companies like GM to keep their workers busy. But those aren't new jobs.
Those companies are in financial distress anyway. There's a lot of question as to whether or not they're even going to survive this bailout.
Absolutely. GM is going, people expect GM to go back in a couple of weeks and ask for more billions of dollars.
What the heck are they spending it on right now? Do you have any idea?
Yes, basically they're spending it on an overhead for a company that isn't able to generate enough money, gross profits in sales, to cover their overhead. They have a real expensive operation. And they have a pension fund contribution per car that makes them non-competitive with other manufacturers. But it's not really necessarily totally the fault of GM. That disparity was caused because the Japanese came into town and went down south where there were no unions, and they put on people at lower rates, and there was no pension for those people because they were just starting to work. So they don't have people that were working for them for 40 years, these Japanese manufacturers. But GM does have people, a lot of people, and they were guaranteeing their people full employment even when the production line stopped. I think they were getting 95% of their salary, and we just can't afford to do that in America. We're not going to be competitive.
Yes.
So
now,
they're going to have to. They should have gone into bankruptcy and just scaled down their requirements. They could have gone into bankruptcy and reduced whatever contracts they wanted to.
Mm-hmm. There are reports that a number of companies that had pension funds no longer have those funds. Now, if that's an issue of the funds having been pooled into these hedge funds and derivatives, then we understand that that money's disappeared. Do you have any information? In other words, when they're saying, well, you know, they're losing money, and is it because of poor manufacturing marketing decisions, or is it because of the pension fund is not performing as it's supposed to?
Well, there's a lot of things. They've been overpaying their people, and they've been doing this because the unions get together and they bring pressure on the manufacturer to play off one against the other, and they get top dollar for their union members. And as long as GM could sell cars in America and make a profit, I guess things were rolling along pretty well. But now the costs of doing this, the continuing escalation of costs, have made the GM non-competitive. But they also had for many, many years what we knew as the argument, the philosophy stated by the president, that small cars mean small profits. And they fought, they resisted for a long time building small cars because the costs of GM were such that you couldn't make cars, small cars, profitably. They needed to make the big cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what they were geared to do. And then other manufacturers came in and started making the high-end cars and then low-end cars. And they were just, surrounding GM and its products, and
mm-hmm.
coming in with lower cost and better quality products,
mm-hmm.
and GM has declined. Chrysler can't stay in business. They always were unable to stay in business. They always needed help.
Mm-hmm.
But when GM kept its prices high, for many years we had a company known as American Motors. And GM and Ford deliberately kept their prices high in order to allow American Motors to operate at a profit.
Mm-hmm.
They sheltered, by having high prices, they sheltered American Motors. So GM didn't mind having high prices. And the Justice Department didn't mind that either, because it kept a fourth manufacturer in business that really couldn't remain in business on a competitive basis.
Yeah.
So American Motors is out, and Chrysler really essentially is out. GM is probably, it should be out, but we're saving it. But notice how these businesses that we're saving, the banks, become larger and larger. Haven't we understood from what's going on that the larger these companies are, the more vulnerable America is when the big company truly fails? The public has to bail them out. Why do we allow them to reach that size?
Well, that's an interesting question, and if I wanted to make a point for the listening audience, and I have basically brought this out in my Obama research in the article, The Three Stooges Go to Washington. That was in the process of determining who the Dunhams were, and I found a connection to the Rockefeller family. And because of the companies and the research I had done on Standard Oil and who really owned Standard Oil, it was being run by the Rockefellers, but they didn't own it. GM was being run here in the United States by agents, but it wasn't an American company per se. It wasn't ultimately owned by an American. Neither was Ford. And is it any surprise that these companies are going down the tubes, causing us to lose dollars, making us virtually non-competitive in the automotive market, and as you pointed out very succinctly, the banks are profiting from this money, but the money ultimately goes to Europe. and this is based on my research on the Pazers, George Pazer and Louis Pazer, who came to the United States. George became George Bayshore, and Louis Cass Pazer ended up building the railroads and then these automotive manufacturers. And in conjunction with the founding of the Federal Reserve, all of these elite American families, such as the Vanderbilts and the Astors and the Rockefellers, on and on, these families were just agents for the Pazers. And the secret agreements written with England, had a lot to do with where we are today, because these agreements have been in force all the time. This is the association between Congress and the Senate, and they're kowtowing to foreign interests. It has nothing to do with America. It has to do with the ownership of these corporations. And we could put other big conglomerates in there, like Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, which were also owned by the Pazers, run out of a company called I forget the name now, but it's a gold mining company out of Alabama that was actually the main company, the umbrella, if you want to call it, for all these other offshoots. So this is quite a mess. We're giving up all this money. There's no accountability. No one will actually show us any documentation, and they're being quite arrogant about that fact. Any comments on that?
What would you think the one, if there was one thing that you could do and only one thing, what would you do to try to clear up this mess in the long run? If you only have one thing, I have a pet thing that I would do. But I just want to see if you and I could reach an agreement on the one thing that could be done to change everything.
Well, for one thing, I have a radio show that's an attempt, okay?
Okay. And I have a way of bringing financial reform and prosperity to any town or village in the United States. But that isn't the problem. This is only dealing with the symptoms. It's trying to fight in our own way, but it doesn't cure the problem. It's an end run around the problem.
Yeah, but I would create something new.
Here is what I think. The one thing that we need is to have public financing of campaigns. If you had honest people running for office and not having to raise money, you would have them making intelligent decisions for the people and not so corporate oriented as we have now. The corporations pay a few bucks here and there, and they get trillions of dollars of benefits. But if people were running for office and they were truly running without commitment to any specific interests, and they all had a right to compete equally with the government financing, basically using media time for free, email to voter registration email lists, radio time, cable time, there really isn't a need for that much actual dollar amounts of financing. You have personnel who need to be paid, but I would say you could run a campaign for $1 billion a year if you have the media being given for free.
Mm-hmm.
So at a cost of $1 billion a year, you can eliminate the trillions of dollars of theft that's taking place and will continue to take place.
Yeah, well, I'm in agreement with you on that. Now, aside from you, let's say, you know, if every town in this country were to have an attorney general on a local level, even if it were only the smaller towns, in what way would that affect a change, a meaningful change?
Well, if you saw problems if you, for example, felt that you knew that Madoff was doing something illegally, and the Attorney General and the SEC wouldn't listen to you, mm-hmm. you could have gone locally to a local town attorney general, of which there would be 40,000 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There would be an enormous number of people, a lot of diversity. Some would say yes and some would say no. But you would have people that you could turn to. And if you had a group of, I mean, envision a network of attorneys general for towns and villages and counties. And they're kept together by a website, county attorney generals, town, village, city attorney generals. And on their website, they have blogs and they talk about problems. That we had a problem here, that we have insurance carriers that refuse to give MRIs when the recommending doctor says that the MRI should be given. They refuse to honor what the doctor says is needed. And maybe if there's enough of that, you would have the Attorney General getting involved and issuing subpoenas and taking a look at the records and seeing whether or not there's a lot of fraud going on, and that the health maintenance organization isn't somehow cooking the books or fudging it and making it appear as if there's no need for it. But you could get records and find out. You could have testimony. But the government at the federal level really doesn't do much of that. So you need to have more people involved. The SEC is rather small. I mean, I was on trial with a stockbroker during the summer and in Manhattan in the federal district court. And this is at a time when the whole country was coming to an end financially. We were seeing the collapse of America. Out of these 7 litigators in the local office of the SEC in New York, 6 of them came into my courtroom to witness an $87,500 case.
Which is preposterous.
What about Madoff? What about all these other things that are happening? I mean, am I the only one doing anything? I mean, So they really aren't operating to protect the people, and you need additional protectors. You need individual people. You need citizens going to somebody and talking about the problems of late fees and tricks. How about the trick of frequently putting Sunday and Saturday as a day that payment is due, knowing that the mail or the email payment can't be made either on a Saturday or Sunday. So you have a late fee. You give a date, and then the date is really impossible to meet.
Mm-hmm.
So they make another 100,000 late fees of $35 each.
So it's really like stealing money. Yeah, if they're holding a deposit, a check or something like that, there's a clearance, and they make sure that they don't count the weekends
right.
in adding up the number of days that they're going to draw interest on that.
So whatever tricks and techniques that have been used by the financial people, you know, a town attorney general would understand that, because this is not real estate. The town attorney general would not be real estate oriented. The town and village have enough of that. They
mm-hmm.
would be more Wall Street oriented, and we can see that Wall Street really needed somebody to be a policeman, because we never had any. So
mm-hmm.
I always envisioned that the town attorney general would be a composite of the following federal and state agencies within a small town. It would
mm-hmm.
be the SEC, the FTC, the FCC, the Justice Department, the EEOC, the Attorney General of the State, Department of Consumer Affairs, a whole bunch of agencies really need to have law enforcement. And when the agency itself isn't doing it, the town attorney general would be the appropriate one to do it on
mm-hmm.
behalf of the residents of the town.
Well, they're not doing it by design. I'm sure you would agree that
they're doing it as a political way of life, that they have decided that you don't need to regulate big business, that big business will take care of itself by self-regulation. And we know that that's just phony, totally phony. And yet the congressman went ahead and they eliminated the Glass-Steagall Act, and that was just criminal for our legislators to do that. Mm-hmm. The Glass-Steagall Act said that our banks should not be involved in doing investment banking. Our mm-hmm. banks should be rigid and adhere to the rules. And maybe those rules were a little bit too expansive, allowing them a multiplier effect that was probably too much.
Mm-hmm.
But they also allowed the banks to go into investment banking, and there, with all the derivatives and credit default swaps and all these exotic instruments, it just has brought down the investment banking field, has brought down the banks, has caused a change in the government of the United States, thank God. And the country is going to take a long time to repair itself.
Mm-hmm.
But there's really a solution. Every town could do it. But if any town wants to do it, Don, you and I are ready to help them do it, because it's so simple. I mean, it's really such a simple thing for a town to bring itself back. I see. I mean, very simple. You don't need any statutes. You only need the will to go ahead and do it, and the town truly should be able to have prosperity once again, even while the rest of the towns in the nation don't have it.
Yes. You know, you brought up several points, so I'd like to come back to Madoff for a second. Now, I've heard initially the charges were the amounts of money that was supposed to have been fraudulently invested or manipulated, moved maybe in a Ponzi scheme. We're talking about $50 billion. Now I'm hearing the figure $1.7 billion. How come such a drastic reduction in the amount of money?
Well, because if the first million that came in, then he would take 10% of the second million and give that to the first million. So you now have 1.9 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the third million comes in, he gives 10% of that to the first 2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And this starts increasing. The more money you have, the larger this vig is that he's giving, that he isn't earning. And it's coming off of the investment, and it's being given back to investors to keep them in, because he doesn't have the money now to give everyone their money back.
Okay.
So
let's
keep
say
giving
in
the
terms,
people.
I was just going to say, and you can answer this along with the answer you were going to give me.
Yeah.
On the basis of, let's say, roughly $667 trillion in phony derivatives and hedge funds, why are they going after Madoff? Is that just a diversionary tactic?
The derivatives problem is one that could really sink the whole economy, and they don't want to face it. There is no money like that to cover it.
How is going after Madoff going to stop that?
Well,
the public
perception that we got everything under control. We now have a person that we see is responsible for all of the evils of the world. But did you ever think of why why Madoff is not in jail?
Well, probably to keep him. I don't know if it's to keep him alive or to keep him quiet.
How about maybe you hit on both concepts? Imagine this: that if Madoff, in fact, had a lot of high political power that was backing him, that helped him in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Madoff is in a position now where he could blackmail them. Right? He could say, I'm going to tell all. And God knows who that would be. It could be anyone, and maybe a lot of people who wouldn't want to be known to have been helping Madoff. So if Madoff were in jail, it'd be difficult to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's possible that he's out on bail because it would be he's more available to if he shuts off if he blabs, it'd probably be easier to get to him. I think he knows a lot, and yet we haven't heard anything at all. We've heard nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that he knows a lot. I mean, he has to, with $50 billion that have passed through his hands with all these people. He knows a lot. And he could sink a lot of careers for a lot of people.
Yeah. I've been following Chris Story's assessment of what's going on, and he goes into quite a bit of detail at his worldreports.org website.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a pretty accurate fix on what's going on, and he's pretty much in agreement with some of the things I've been saying about all of this real estate corruption. This is the banks and the fraudulent schemes that are doing this. It's not to be blamed exclusively on people who are having trouble meeting their mortgages. That's been a problem since they started mortgages. That's always been there. They've always had foreclosures, but never in the numbers that they're having them now, and that's because of this issue of the foreign bank accounts having been frozen. To admit that that is the cause is admitting that the embezzlement is going on. It's pretty simple. It works, you know, in both directions. So I'm of the understanding that as of December 18th, 2008, the tier 1 through 10 payments were made to various countries. Originally, Vladimir Putin was supposed to get $30 billion, and he upped that amount to $59 billion. And that was bringing us on the verge of war. There were certainly some skirmishes going on internationally that were not reported in the mainstream media, but did hit the alternative media. And we talked about those things on this very show. So that international component to this whole scandal has sort of backed off a bit because of these payments. However, you still have the same issues of these foreign banks owning such massive tracts of land in the United States, unbeknownst to the average person, because these are these electronic transfers that are taking place over computers, where the mortgage holders are unaware that their contracts have been given away to another bank that moves into foreclose. I mean, this is criminal, what's going on.
I've created a defense in mortgage foreclosures, which I call the It's a Wonderful Life defense. And I say that it is a defense to the foreclosure action that the bank has sold out its interest and securitized it, because now the borrower does not have a bank that it can turn to in time of trouble and say, can you give me a break? And that is part of what a mortgagee relationship is, that you can go to the bank and they'll have a heart and maybe help you out. But when you have sold your mortgage to 1,000 or 10,000 people, you don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So I call that my It's a Wonderful Life defense, that James Stewart movie, where he was the head of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And use the bank to help the people. And basically, in what I see as a reformed town and village, it would be ideal for the town people to deal with a local bank that wouldn't be victimized by the big city banks and all the toxicity that they spread.
Mm-hmm.
We find in New York that the local banks weren't really participants in the toxic mortgages. They weren't allowed to participate, and for that reason they're in good financial shape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that a town should work to, is to try to have local interests who care, and you can work with local people. We have to go back to that. I think we have to try to develop local manufacturing, local financial institutions, and not have the this a big corporate bank that does everything. It's now fallen apart. We see that it was not a sound way of going to have a bank with all that, having one sales rep that can sell mortgages and can sell exchanges of money and can sell vacations and deposits and transfers and all of these different things, investment products, stocks and bonds and treasuries. I mean, having one bank do everything is, we now see, too complicated, and it leads to a lot of problems, and it just about has caused the bank to go under.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have banking, and we ought to have banking where maybe they don't create as much money as they are doing. Maybe they should have greater restrictions on the kind of loans that they can meet so that they are in better shape. But these are things that honest politicians would look at if we elected them using public money.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as we don't have public money financing elections, we're not going to have really the necessary review of all the things that need to be done. So business as usual is what we are going to have, except in the local level, you and I can do something about it. And anyone in any town or village can do something about it.
Now, one issue that comes up, and a lot of towns do this, let's say a town is interested in providing some sort of insurance to their population, we'll say, and this might be house, insurance, mortgage insurance, liability insurance in relation to owning a home, sidewalk issues or a tree falling or something like that. God forbid something worse happening to the house. But in the case of also health insurance, and the fact that there are these companies like AIG, for example, huge companies that are called insurance companies on one end, and on the other end they're called holding companies, and they're taking this the funds that they're holding, rightfully to earn a profit on interest. Okay, so what do? They invest it in real estate, then the real estate goes into these hedge funds, and it all becomes worthless. This is why we're bailing out companies like AIG. Can we do anything to stop that? Or is it within our means to create our own types of insurance to help someone truly in need? And I'm talking about regular citizens, not these corporations.
Well, the every state has insurance laws, and you wouldn't lawfully be able to create an insurance company. But I think you could get people in town to focus on an insurance company that was pure insurance, meaning the one that wasn't encumbered with all these other problems. I mean, it seems to me that trying to put together a conglomerate that the whole purpose was to take business away from everyone else, because you had representatives across the whole array of services, and when they saw one of their customers was going to buy a house, then the person that was the representative for insurance would then contact the house broker part of the business. The house broker would call up the furniture part of the business. I mean, there was this cross-referring that was thought to be a tremendous model, or they would have the ability to do better than any other company, and what they did was they collapsed. It just doesn't work. Too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to put all that stuff together and make sense out of it. Just focus on your core business and try to keep that alive and try not to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that having a local bank, a savings and loan, issue the mortgages would be a nice thing instead of having a big conglomerate do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's I'm just talking about possibilities as alternative solutions. You mentioned early on in this show, Carl, that Some of these insurance companies are refusing to pay certain expenditures that are prescribed by a doctor to a patient. Say, for example, an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, or maybe even a CAT scan. I know this, or it could be something cost prohibitive.
Yeah.
Shouldn't there be some regulation that limits the amount of money for these things? I'll tell you from personal experience. I had to have an MRI a number of years ago. It was a result of being rear-ended by somebody going 60 miles an hour while I was sitting still at a traffic light.
Mm, good God.
Okay. Now, I had problems with my neck and my shoulder, and the problems really mushroomed within a year after this. I hadn't really gone for any therapy or anything because nothing, you know, really traumatic seemed to be occurring until eventually, you know, we can relate all of this to that event. I'll tell you, you don't want to go through what you go through with doctors that are misdiagnosing what the problem is. And I ended up going through MRIs, and the first MRI was like $1,500 for 45 minutes. That's insanity. Now, a week or two later, I get a call from the diagnostic lab where the MRI machine was. I think it was a Siemens, if I remember correctly, too. And they're telling me they got some new software, and the pictures that they took didn't come out that well, so they wanted to take another set. They figured they would get better results because they couldn't tell what the problem was. And here they're using probably stolen Tesla coils, you know, in the invention. So I go back a second time, and I said, you know, is there going to be a charge for this? Because the first time we paid $1,500 and you're saying it didn't work. You know, the insurance is paying for this, but nonetheless, this is, this seems outrageous. The amount of money you're charging, and you cannot produce any kind of results except no results. You know, of course, I couldn't get a straight answer. Anyway, this went on three times until they could actually get a reading. So should we be paying for experimental treatments or diagnosis? And shouldn't there be a ceiling as to what can be charged for this? It's absurd.
There are so many problems, and a lot of the problems, I think, are the result of not having a single-payer system. You have a lot of bureaucracy that each step along the way in a chain of three or four different entities, each one tries to protect itself from giving up too much money. And the net result is that it's overloading with bureaucratic activities where it could take an hour to try to schedule a session with somebody because of the approvals that you need. So there's costs here that you wouldn't have in a single-payer system.
Mm-hmm.
Single-payer system and one that isn't based on employment, but the right of everyone to have medical care with a single payer. The way they do it now, you need to have employment, and many people aren't employed. Benefits are being reduced anyway. So I think it's getting worse from a healthcare standpoint, in spite of the fact that healthcare accounts for 20% of our economy.
Mm-hmm. What is your feeling about these laws that are being created, or rumored to be created, complying or demanding that citizens comply with certain types of vaccinations that A, have not been tested, or actually Trojan horses for other diseases that guarantee these pharmaceutical companies future business? What is your feeling about that?
Well, to me, you need full disclosure, and it has to be done with permission. And what they're doing, what I thought they were doing, is getting people in prison to agree to test these vaccinations or other things in exchange for payment or something. But if the government says that you have to have these shots. I mean, the government does it when you're in the military. They tell you what you have to have.
Oh, yes, I know.
They do it already.
Yeah, these cases are springing up all over the country where people are fighting these forced vaccinations going on in the schools.
Well, okay, is it it's a requirement now in school to give, let's say, diphtheria or measles or what? What do they have? What are the mandatory ones?
Well, I don't know specifically what the mandatory requirements are in the schools. They may say, well, you have to have the basic shots. We understand that there's some 110 vaccines being given to newborns in the first 3 months of their lives. And these are combination vaccines that are repeatedly resulting in autism and in some cases the very diseases that they're purported to be being vaccinated against. So these things that, you know, I'm hearing about cases in New Jersey, for example, where there's a couple that's gone before a judge and they refuse to get these vaccines for their children. They're being told not only are the kids not going to be allowed to go to school, but they're going to be put in prison for this. Mm-hmm. We're certainly entering a totalitarian state across the country in terms of these things, and they're trying to condition us to get us to say, well, you know, I don't want to go through this. I don't want to lose my children, so we better do this. This is criminal, what's going on. We have a right to know what they're putting in these things, first of all. And my guess is that they were never needed. If God intended for us to be vaccinated, we would have had syringes built into us when we were born. And the funnels to fill them up.
Yeah, there are a lot of civil rights problems there, no doubt about it. And I think the town attorney general, particularly if there's a lot of them and they gather together, they can have a lot of strength. If you have 10 or 20 town attorneys general coming together and saying, hey, let's bring a suit, and they could do that. You'd share the work, share the cost, and cure a common problem, and it would have greater force. I mean, the state attorneys general do that. They have an organization of state attorneys general, and they talk about common problems. I guess AIG was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they gather. Well, cigarettes was one of them, and most of these state attorneys general gathered, joined the lawsuit, and the net result was that they got billions of dollars per state in settlement.
Yeah, and the money disappeared.
They're now the protectors of cigarettes.
Yes, and the money's disappeared too.
Oh, yeah, the money is given to their friends. I mean, it's friendly broadcasters or whoever. Somebody's getting the money, but you and I don't.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
And they keep increasing the cost. Cigarettes they're proposing to make a major increase in the cost of cigarettes in New York. I mean, I haven't smoked since age 17. So I did it cold turkey. I just quit. I read about the cancer scare. I said, nope, that's it. I'm off of it. That's it. I never took another cigarette, but I kept a package of cigarettes on me for many months just in case I broke down. I wouldn't have to run anywhere. I kept these cigarettes, and they got stale, and I never used them.
Hmm. And how much were they back then, a pack?
10 cents. 10 cents a pack.
My goodness.
Yep, 20 cigarettes, 10 cents.
And they're probably, what, 400 or 500% over that?
Well, they were, it was actually, this is in a PX.
Oh, no, 4,000%, excuse me.
Yeah, in an army, it was a carton cost a dollar, and now a carton costs 8 times 10 is like $80. So it's 80, it's 8,000%.
8,000%.
Yeah.
Okay, shows how much I know. Yeah, that's quite a markup. It's very similar to what they're doing in the pharmaceutical industry and in the petroleum industry as well. Which brings us back to why these excuses that we get about making a car that can get certain number of miles per gallon, you know, basically saving oil. I'm appalled when I think that they have cars that can drive hundreds of miles on 8 ounces of water, that technology exists. You would think that they would be jumping to do that if they really wanted to save the automotive industry, and it's very inexpensive to do this. And it doesn't result in any sort of negative performance in the vehicles that use this technology. And it reduces pollution. It reduces Al Gore's pet peeve, global warming, while I look at 3 feet of snow outside my house. You know, it's just one lie after another. And I don't know. I think we should have some recourse over these things that are being done, because they're not sensible. They're not logical. No one is accountable for it, and we shouldn't be tolerating it.
Well, a free college would help out to give people a better education, and it would lead to better publications, which gave really better news, and we could bring in manufacturing and recreate a better economy. I mean, there are things that we can do locally, and we should, and it's so obvious that these things can be done, but it seems like nobody really has that much of an interest in trying to make things better. Maybe there's a built-in bias against change, because who knows, if change comes along, maybe the person will lose whatever they have. The politicians will lose. The politicians don't want change, because once you're elected, you're always re-elected, most of the time anyway. And if you made it competitive where anyone could get the same financing just by running for office, that would mean that the politicians really would not be there forever.
Yeah, there's got lose. To be some means of really holding an honest, above-board election, too. I saw a map yesterday. Someone sent me a map of the United States according to the election results, and all the McCain states were in red. And why didn't he win the election? if this map is accurate, we have yet another fraud attributed to the Barack Obama camp, and including now more bogus signatures of Stanley and Dunham, and I use that in quotes, on marital and immigration and divorce documents. Totally different from her signature in her high school yearbook. So, again, we can prove Obama is a fraud. Why are we even considering allowing this guy to go into the White House?
Probably what would happen, it appears that the powers that be or the courts are saying that this is a political issue. It is such a fundamental issue that the public had to decide it, and it doesn't matter what the Constitution says, it becomes really a public issue, because there would be people taking to the streets, you'd have a riot, you'd have real chaos, possibly, if the results of the election were overturned because of that legal problem.
Isn't statement in and of itself a kind of an oxymoron? It's a political issue. Actually, it's a political election. What else would you call it?
Yeah. And what they did was that the voters voted, and they knew about that issue, and they didn't care, so the voters have changed the Constitution.
Well, in a sense, that's true, but when they refuse to hear these cases, these suits have been filed in the Supreme Court. We have Leo Donofrio, and we have Phil Berg, and we have Andy Martin. I mean, these cases are being thrown out of court by the guy who's going to do the swearing in at the inauguration. There seems to be a conflict of interest going on.
Well, kicking them out is a decision. When they don't allow them in, they're saying that we're not going to change anything. We're not going to go your way. So they reject them. It's when they accept cases that they have four votes already, or at least four acceptance.
Yeah. So
here, when they just reject the petition, it means forget it. You know, it's hopeless, and that means that they've decided probably on the grounds that the voters have voted, and we're not going to change it. But look, the Supreme Court can really pretty much do anything it wants to. It can designate the winner in an election, and they did it with Bush.
That's what the point I was going to bring up is they've already set precedents, and they did make a political decision in the court. So
don't expect consistency.
Or honesty, maybe?
You expect only results.
Mm-hmm. Well, I keep saying we have to learn how to spell just us.
Yeah.
The U.S. Just Us Department. I hate to be so harsh, but it makes no sense. I mean, the arguments that are being put forth in these decisions that are rendered, or the decision to not render a decision, is insanity. And I know I'm not alone in that. People are appalled at what's going on. Now, if that's the case, then haven't they turned that back over to the states? Doesn't that become a state issue?
They've already voted.
Well,
the electors have voted.
Yeah, but we've also been given fraudulent voting results, too, through the media. The media has conspired to spin the outcome of the results. And we had, even in the primaries, in these caucuses that were going on, we actually have film of a single voters voting as many as 80 times.
Really?
On video. Oh, yes. This has been documented. Or the sealing and the unsealing of the ballots in New Hampshire. That's on videotape, that you can remove the seals and literally remove them just by peeling them off, and they reattach back onto the boxes without tearing the cardboard. And that's on videotape. It left in unsealed rooms, unprotected, where people were, after they closed buildings at 9 o'clock at night, people were going back in 11:30 at night, midnight, into the morning hours, taking boxes out. We know that there was fraud. I mean, this has been documented, but nobody's going to investigate the fraud because the people voted? That's a silly argument there. There's an argument, there's evidence of fraud. So, I don't know. It's uncomfortable for people to deal with this in many ways, yet it doesn't make the problem go away. I think we should be dealing with it. I think we should not ignore it, and we should do something about it. I really do. I feel very strongly about that. That's the problem with the world today. That's the problem with this country, is that we see a problem, and we want to take the easiest way to solve it instead of looking at what the problem is and going after the source of the problem. And if it's people, then you deal with those people. If it's policies, you deal with the policies. But to have us just have to accept everything that's doled out to us just because it's done under the color of authority doesn't make it right. That's my rant for this evening, Carl.
Pretty good.
And I think, in a sense, you would agree with me.
Yeah, we need a system that will allow us to present our grievances and to have them decided fairly and do so inexpensively. Do you know what arbitration costs?
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy expensive.
Here's what happens. See, big companies that want to force people into arbitration do that because if you go to court, you pay $100, $200, or $300 filing fee, And if your lawyer is on a contingency, it doesn't cost you too much more than that. But if you go into arbitration, the same lawsuit will cost you $30,000, possibly, of arbitrator's fees. So the people that are told that you will get a speedier, a more efficient, less costly system for resolving your dispute, it's just not true. By designating arbitration, they really have taken away all relief whatsoever. And nobody knows that.
Yeah,
so these are the things that the establishment have done. This is just one of many things that they have done to take away our rights. They've eliminated the right to a jury trial by passing a statute that makes it mandatory to go to arbitration if you sign that agreement that was written by the big company, which you can't modify, which says, and you never even read it anyway, but all disputes will be resolved in arbitration. And in putting that in there, you now have no remedy at all, because you can't afford that $30,000.
Yeah, nice system. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's a nice system that they have developed. Everywhere you turn, they eliminate the Glass-Steagall Act, they eliminate usury, they make it difficult to bring lawsuits, then they make it, they take away any right to litigate by forcing you into arbitration. They just have people working on every aspect of our system and changing what we thought we had into now giving us virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm. What about the some of the laws or even the Constitution? I mean, if you look at our Constitution in terms of what is there that has been sort of buried under a lot of paperwork,
the right to a jury trial.
Yes, for example,
we've lost it. We don't have it. The judges decide motions for summary judgment, and most cases are thrown out and never have a jury. And those are the cases in court. The cases that never get to court are the arbitration, and there people can't afford it, so they don't get arbitration either.
Mm-hmm.
But this system is really well put together in order to take away the rights of people. They've done one brilliant job at it, and we have our elected politicians to thank for it. They're the ones, as they're smiling at us and asking for our vote, they're the ones who created this, and they did it knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
And we have got to get rid of them by having government financing of the elections and no private financing.
Well, do you think they're going to say, well, okay, you win, we'll do it? Do you really think that's going to happen?
Well, if we work at it on a town-by-town basis, we might effect a reform.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't see going around door by door in Congress and asking them to change it. I think we have to change the people, educate the people, and get them motivated to having a better system.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can change it on a grassroots basis.
Yeah. Now, Barack Obama has promised change. He ran on that promise of change. And it appears to be everything is the same as it was before, and it's going to continue to be that. Or
It just appears that way.
Or it's going to continue to get worse.
Well, yeah, it'll probably be that way, but he doesn't have the power himself to do that much. He has the bully pulpit, but he doesn't sign. He doesn't pass these statutes. I mean, he will sign them if they've been passed by Congress. But you have all these people with this adverse interest who are going to protect themselves and the people that hired them to go into the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for him to do anything, but he's going to put a happy face on it and make us feel good to some extent. I hope he will do something, but I can't see him putting a free college in every town and village in the U.S. I don't see him giving jobs for everyone in town that wants a job, whereas the MyClads website will give earnings to anyone that wants to earn money. I mean, mm-hmm. We can do things in a town that you just can't have a government doing, except the local government.
Yes. Not that I want to change the subject here, but this is along the same lines. I've had a few listeners ask me about this issue of, let's say, condoning the nomination of Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. Is that normal for these procedures to occur before the person that actually nominated her takes office? He's the president-elect. He's not the president. He's appointed someone, or, you know, put out the request to put this person in a position, but he is still not in office. Is this just more of ramrodding Obama through the process?
That's interesting. I never thought of that before as to whether it represents an issue or not. But I guess the Senate can pretty much do whatever it wants to do. It determines its own agenda.
If that's constitutional and or even legal to do that.
Well, there's no remedy. It's political, and the courts would not entertain a lawsuit to say that they can't do it. So whether you think it's legal or not, it's a political question. And you're just not going to have a court upsetting it. So if you don't have a court upsetting it, you have no remedy. So it doesn't really matter whether it's legal or not.
My problem, Carl, and probably the problem of most of the listening audience, except the agencies that are listening in, is politics. What gives them the right to be sovereign over all the billions of lives on this planet? What gives them, because they wear a suit, they lie, they cheat, they steal, amongst other things, what gives them the right really to, you know, this word politics is filthy.
They have the right because the people who stole the money stole it because we didn't enforce our laws, our antitrust laws, other laws. We stole our money, and now they have excess money to give to steal our government. So that's what gives them the right. Might makes right, and they have it. They have our money, and they have our government. So that's where the power is, and they can do anything they want. And I think what's left for us is at the lowest level.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just sorting this out because, you know, people wanted to hear these questions, and I think that there's an issue there that could, you know, maybe throw a wrench in the works. They do what they want to do. Well, you know, when we catch them in the act, I think it's different from being hoodwinked or having it go on behind closed doors. They're doing this right under our noses. I'm seriously wondering if there's any legality to this whatsoever.
Well, what difference does legality mean if you have to bring it to one of their judges?
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's no remedy here. You're going to go up to one of their judges and say, hey, I think you're doing wrong. And they will smile and say, thank you for your concern. Case dismissed.
Well, that's if you follow administrative law.
Well, it's in a district court, and not administrative law is generally the administrative agencies. If you would go to the SEC and make a complaint, there you would have a law judge that would hear it and so on. But if you have a complaint of the type that you mentioned, you would file it in court. And a judge would take a look at it and say, oh, forget this stuff. I'm going to dismiss this case. There's no way that I'm going to hold that the government is unconstitutional.
I detect a bit of sarcasm in that statement.
Well, no, that's what they do. I mean, people bring suits like that a lot of the time, and the courts always dismiss it. When have they held the government to be unconstitutional? They just don't do it.
Even when it is unconstitutional.
Well, it doesn't matter because those are the people that are in control determine what's constitutional.
Okay. Now, what you're proposing we do on the local level is constitutional.
Well, the Constitution doesn't arise. It's not an issue. If you go in there and you try to get jobs for people, you're not worried about the Constitution. If you give them a free college, that's not a constitutional issue.
Yeah. When you're taking away people's rights, I guess you're not worried about the Constitution. Or
well, the question is the question of whether there's a remedy. We see rights being taken away, but what's the remedy? Practically speaking,
yeah.
Do you have access to the main press to alert the public about it? And the answer is no. You're not going to get a front page story in the New York Times.
No.
If you go into court and you claim that these things are wrong and you want relief, the judges will throw you out. So you don't really have a remedy here. So it isn't that we don't have concern. It's just that the system will not allow itself to be corrected that readily.
Mm-hmm. Understand, I'm speaking for my listening audience, you know, because these issues come up all the time.
But we can do something locally. We can make our lives better locally. And just be concerned about what's happening at the higher level of government. But we have less opportunity of affecting it. We can we have a great opportunity of affecting things where we live.
Okay. Time for one more comment, Carl. And I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
What would be the most effective way of getting this message that you're bringing to us again tonight on Evident Footprints to these people who have lost their jobs, who have lost their pension, who have skills, who are willing to work? What is the best way for us, as you can see it, to get this message out?
Here's the best way of doing it. Invite us in to help the community list itself on the website, and then have the community advertise the website in the 25-mile radius around the town. And it doesn't cost that much, but it will be effective for bringing in money. Towns are willing to spend money to bring tourists into town. What about bringing dollars into town? Instead of tourists, how about bringing customers? And they can do it very inexpensively, because all over the world people need different skills and different things. Services, skills, insight, goods, and whatever. So whatever people have in a given town can be listed for free on the website, and then we can market that website inexpensively because it has everything, and do it only in a small radius, a 25-mile radius. And we can bring in $100 or $200 per person, per resident of the town, per day.
Mm-hmm.
They can start making money.
Now, you're saying this can be done without going through the normal rigmarole that we have to go through other systems. This would be a system that could survive on its own.
If a town is willing to do it, because I'm not going to throw $20,000 into advertising. I don't get anything out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to put up the money. We're trying to list people for free, but someone, and that is the town, is going to have to market the website. And the town has enough costs and welfare and other things where it would have an interest in trying to alleviate that by this approach. And if it doesn't work, then they stop doing it. But towns put a lot of money into different things that don't work. I think this will work.
Yes. And that's just a fraction of what would come in. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket, really.
Yeah, yeah.
If that large. So, well, Carl, we're out of time.
Okay.
I want to direct folks to a couple of your websites that I know they'll find very interesting. The one we've been talking about, MyClads, that's MyClads.com. Carl's got another website that deals with a lot of legal issues, Law Mall, that's LAWMALL.com, and an interesting one, which is sort of an opinion blog, as far as I can see, but with some very accurate information, is the Daily BSD, and that's .com, DailyBSD.com. Any other ones you want to promote, Carl? Out of
for people that are interested in mortgages, regardless of whether they're a judicial foreclosure or non-judicial, my law site as a lawyer, carlperson.com, has a lot of information.
Okay.
A lot. Just very helpful stuff.
And that's CARLPERSON. If you're not sure about the spelling, go to my website, directlightproductions.com, look at radio schedule, click on January 14th, and you will see the correct spelling of Carl's name. Carl, it's been very interesting.
Sure.
I know things are moving along for Hopeless Indiana.
Terrific.
And so I look forward to talking to you in the very, very, very near future.
Terrific.
And look forward to your next visit on the show.
Very good. Thanks a lot and good night.
Okay, same to you.
Right.
Don't hang up on us yet, Carl.
Okay,
so we don't get that nasty tone.
Okay.
Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Carl Pearson. You can visit his websites, again, myclads.com, lawmall.com, Carl Pearson, that's spelled like person, PERSON.com, and dailybsd.com. That one you'll enjoy. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us tomorrow night when our special guest will be Mr. Michael Anthony. In the meantime, I wish you all a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.